Authorities have arrested a suspect in a string of school bomb threats in Helena. Good evening, I'm Connor Valentine.
And I'm Madeline Beck, and Capitol reporter Dan Boyce has our top story tonight on Montana Evening Edition.
We'll also have an update on the approaching deadline to sign up for Obamacare. And in our feature interview, News Director Sally Mock talks with historian Kathleen Cahill about the role of women in the early years of the Bureau of Indian Affairs. Authorities have arrested a 14-year-old California boy in connection with a series of bomb threats this week in Helena. Helena schools were evacuated this morning in what turned out to be the third hoax in 4 days. Officials quickly sent all students in grades K through 12 to predetermined evacuation areas and canceled the school day after the threat was phoned in. Capitol reporter Dan Boyce says law enforcement is looking to press charges.
A long line of students and parents waits in the state capitol rotunda, not to learn about the building's history or to visit the governor's office.
We're being evacuated. We're signing parents and students out.
That's a Jefferson Elementary School secretary. The Capitol building is where Jefferson students go when evacuated. After checking their child's name off a green sheet of paper, parents are scrambling to figure out what to do with them for the day. Heidi O'Brien is taking her two boys to work with her.
You know, it upsets everyone's schedules.
She says she's torn. One part of her is happy the police are taking these threats seriously.
Yes, they should be. And then the other part of me is like, if this is a joke, like this is just such a sick joke.
Someone may take this as a joke. We don't.
Lewis and Clark County Sheriff Leo Dutton.
We'll pursue it. We'll find you and we'll prosecute.
And police have found a suspect. The first bomb threat called in on Tuesday said there was a bomb in Capitol High's gym. The second call, Wednesday, threatened Helena Elementary Schools. Researching the calls led authorities to think they may have been coming from out of state.
All the IP addresses, all the Wi-Fi connections, there are just so many ways you can connect with people this day and age. But all of them you can trace backwards.
Police Chief Troy McGee says his department asked the FBI for help.
Shortly after the call this morning, a 14-year-old suspect was picked up in Dublin, California, by their police department per our request.
The Lewis and Clark County Attorney's Office has been in contact with a prosecutor in California to sort out what charges may be filed against this boy. The police department says, for an adult, each threat would have been a separate charge of felony intimidation, punishable by up to 10 years in prison, a $50,000 fine, or both, again, for an adult. Helena Schools Superintendent Kent Colchin says the school district will find a way to make up the lost time, either through adding a school day or slightly extending remaining days, yet he says it won't replace the continuity of education the students would have had.
So when you get down right to the basis of the education of the child, it's really disrupting. It's disrupting to the child themselves as another bomb threat because we really want to offer a safe and secure environment for those children.
But as parent Heidi O'Brien is walking out of the Capitol building with her two kids, her 8-year-old boy Shannon says the bomb threat didn't really scare him.
The first time we had it, it was a fake, and then I kept on hearing about more fake bomb threats, so I kind of caught on that I don't think there would actually be a real bomb in one of the schools.
Unfortunately, adults can't think of it that way. I'm Dan Boyce reporting in Helena.
And in other news from around the state, an order of nuns being sued by people who claim they were sexually abused as children at the Ursuline Academy in St. Ignatius is asking a federal judge to delay the proceedings while the Roman Catholic Diocese of Helena is in bankruptcy court. District Judge Jeffrey Sherlock of Helena halted sex abuse lawsuits against the Ursulines and the diocese after the diocese filed for bankruptcy protection as part of a proposed $15 million settlement. Sherlock previously combined the proceedings in the two lawsuits filed by the total of 362 alleged victims. But the Ursulines are not participating in the settlement, and victims' attorneys want a federal bankruptcy judge to lift the stay in that state lawsuit. The Ursulines say the case can't properly proceed without participation of the diocese.
Federal regulators say Montana's Public Service Commission is improperly hindering small, renewable energy projects in the state. The Federal Energy Regulatory Commission said yesterday that the rules the PSC created to implement a federal energy conservation policy create, quote, an unreasonable obstacle for the independent projects seeking to sell their power. Part of the Public Utility Regulatory Policies Act of 1978 created an obligation for utilities to offer to purchase power from small, renewable power production facilities of 80 megawatts or less. Several small power projects in Montana complained to FERC, arguing Montana's rules require projects larger than 10 megawatts to win a competitive bid, but that Northwestern Energy doesn't offer enough bidding opportunities. With the order, the PSC can either change its rules or the power developers can pursue the issue in court.
Flooding and ice jams have prompted federal officials to close most boat launches along a 149-mile stretch of the Upper Missouri River in central Montana. Floods that began in early March pushed ice blocks up to 4 feet high into campgrounds and recreation areas overseen by the U.S. Bureau of Land Management. BLM spokesman Jonathan Moore said today the ice has blocked the launches and could delay campground openings later this spring. Launches are closed in the communities of Virgil and Loma and where the river intersects with the Route 236 southeast of Big Sandy and U.S. Highway 191 in Fergus County. The BLM says the above-average snowpack in the Upper Missouri Basin could cause more hazardous flooding in coming months.
The deadline for signing up for the Affordable Care Act is fast approaching. Montanans have until March 31st. State Insurance Commissioner Monica Lindeen and Christine Kaufman, a navigator with the Montana Primary Care Association, were in Missoula today promoting the sign-up. As of the end of February, 22,500 Montanans had applied for the health insurance. Though that's a high rate compared to many other states, it's still far below the nearly 200,000 Montanans who are eligible. Lindeen says there are several reasons people have not signed up.
One of the obstacles has obviously been a lot of the misinformation that was put out there for, you know, 2 or 3 years prior to open enrollment. The second obstacle probably has to do with the original rollout where there were technical issues, which have pretty much been resolved at this point. And I think the third is just the fact that a lot of folks who have never purchased insurance still, you know, haven't realized that that they need to do that.
Navigator Chris Kaufman says many of those who don't realize they need insurance are people who are young and healthy.
You know, this idea that they're young and invincible, of course, it isn't the truth. Everybody has the potential to be in an accident or life-threatening illness of some sort that would completely bankrupt them into the future, more likely bankrupt their parents. And I think young people need to think about that their parents will do anything for them, including sell their house and give away their life savings if their child needs that kind of support. So a piece of this is for young people to take responsibility and understand they have a commitment, and not only to their families, but to their community to make this thing work.
There are also many uninsured people who would like to sign up, but are too poor to qualify. They would have been covered if Montana had opted to approve Medicaid expansion, but the legislature chose not to, arguing it would cost the state too much money in the long run. Kaufman says many of those ineligible low-income people use the services of the state's community health clinics.
And, you know, unfortunately, our outreach and enrollment assisters in those clinics have to be the bearer of bad news far too often. And I think that's another reason for the low numbers, because such an emphasis has been placed on getting people in who are uninsured, and then they don't qualify. And it's a heartbreaking situation.
Supporters of Medicaid expansion hope to get voters to pass an initiative endorsing it, but funding would still need to be approved by the next legislature. For those eligible Montanans who don't sign up by March 31st and who remain uninsured, Lindeen reminds them they may have to pay a penalty on their taxes next year.
If you don't have insurance, you're going to have to actually either provide some type of a form, which you can get through healthcare.gov, which shows that you are exempt from actually having coverage, because there are some exemptions for folks, including people who obviously can't afford it. And if not that, then yes, you would pay a penalty.
The penalty the first year is 1% of your taxable income, or $95, whichever amount is greater, and the amount goes up each year after that. Lindeen and Kaufman expect a last-minute rush of signups and urge people to not wait until the last day. Once again, the deadline is March 31st. For more information, go to the websites healthcare.gov or montanahealthanswers.com.
Police in Missoula say there was no foul play involved in the death of an Idaho man whose body was found along the railroad tracks in North Missoula. Police said today the investigation into the death of 34-year-old Keith William Byington had been completed and that it was not the result of criminal activity. Byington's body was discovered in the Montana Rail Link Yard on March 4th by an MRL employee. An autopsy determined Byington died from injuries sustained after being hit or dragged by a train. An obituary posted on the website of Wood River Chapel in Haley, Idaho, said Byington died on February 28th. He had lived in Haley and Gannett. Sergeant Travis Welsh says Byington had lived in the Missoula area for less than a year.
Butte Silverbow County officials have released the name of the 72-year-old man who died after his throat was cut during an argument at a Butte assisted living facility. Coroner Lee LaBresche said today his office is still looking for relatives of Jerry Diltz, who died early Wednesday at Continental Gardens. Witnesses told police 72-year-old John Edward Grubbs Sr. slashed Diltz's throat with a large butcher knife during an alcohol-fueled fight about money at about 2 a.m. Wednesday. Facility employees called police. Grubbs is charged with deliberate homicide and is jailed with bail set at $250,000.
A sentencing date has been set for a Washington State man who pleaded guilty to beating and stabbing his 3-year-old son to death in a field in southwestern Montana, possibly while under the influence of an overdose of a prescribed stimulant. The Montana Standard reports Jeremy Kramer of Lacey, Washington, is scheduled to be sentenced on April 4th in district court in Anaconda. Kramer pleaded guilty to deliberate homicide in December for the July 8th death of Broderick Kramer. The boy's body was found the next morning in a field about 5 miles southeast of Anaconda. Prosecutors agreed to recommend a sentence of life in prison with no parole restrictions. Judge Lauren Tucker has said he is not bound by the plea agreement. Kramer has been jailed since Anaconda police arrested him at a convenience store where he was trying to wash his son's blood from his clothes.
A 25-year-old Hamilton man has denied allegations that he beat and stomped another man to death in January. KCITV reports Richard Michael Sullivan pleaded not guilty yesterday to deliberate homicide in the January 28th death of 25-year-old Robert Thott. Prosecutors say Sullivan and his wife had been drinking at Thott's house when Sullivan became angry because Thott smelled Candace Sullivan's hair. An autopsy found Thott suffered blunt force trauma to his abdomen up to 2 hours before the 911 call was made and could have survived with prompt medical attention. He also suffered numerous blows to the head and a broken nose. District Judge James Haynes continued Sullivan's bail at $200,000.
A former substitute teacher at Browning Middle School has been sentenced to 2.5 years in federal prison for having a sexual relationship with a 14-year-old student last spring. The U.S. Attorney's Office says 22-year-old Tyrell Lee Balabardin of Browning was sentenced Tuesday by U.S. District Judge Brian Morris in Great Falls. Balabardin pleaded guilty in December to sexual abuse of a minor. He will be required to register as a sexual offender.
The Montana Department of Environmental Quality announced today it's extending the comment period on a proposed cleanup plan of Missoula's White Pine Sash Superfund facility. The move follows growing local calls for the state to consider a more comprehensive cleanup, one more appropriate for residential use. White Pine Sash was a wood, window, and door component manufacturing facility which operated on Missoula's north side from the 1920s through 1996. From the mid-1930s until 1987, milled wood products were dipped into mixtures of pentachlorophenol and petroleum products. Some of those chemicals were released into the environment, contaminating soil and groundwater. Current zoning allows for a mix of commercial, residential, and light industrial uses. DEQ spokesman Chris Sager says the proposed cleanup plan is appropriate for its current intended uses.
And so it's being cleaned up to those standards. But again, you know, we've heard a lot from people, and we want to continue to hear from people and, you know, keep a conversation going with people in Missoula about the best way to approach this issue. So I think it would be hard to quantify off the top of my head, but, you know, we had a very well-attended public meeting, heard a lot of great substantive comments from people who are very well-versed in the issue and care a lot about it, and that's part of the reason why we're going to continue to hear from them.
A Missoula City Council committee passed a resolution this week urging the full council to recommend DEQ request a higher level of cleanup more appropriate for residential use. That vote is expected early next week. Sager says a DEQ staffer will call into that council meeting to address any technical issues. He says public comment and concern is very important to the decision-making process.
Well, it's very valuable. You know, we have to look at a range of factors, including, you know, our scientific analysis of the characteristics of this site. But certainly what people in Missoula have to say about it is very important because, after all, this is Missoula's community. This is property in Missoula. So we want to hear from the public about what they have to say.
DEQ's new comment period deadline is now April 14th. For more information, Google White Pine Sash and Montana DEQ.
The Idaho legislature has passed a bill to create a state board that will work to control the growth of wolf populations in the state. The measure, known as House Bill 470, was passed yesterday on the final day of the session. The bill creates a $400,000 fund that the board will use to reduce conflicts between wolves and wildlife or livestock. The money comes from fees on sportsmen and livestock industry. Governor C.L. Butch Otter is expected to sign the bill into law. Otter had sought $2 million in the Wolf Fund.
Law enforcement officers are investigating an armed bank robbery in Browning. Officials say a Native American man in his early 20s robbed the Native American bank at about 9 this morning. Tribal Homeland Security Director Earl Blackweasel tells the Great Falls Tribune the robber left the bank on foot with an undisclosed amount of cash. He was wearing a blue and white hoodie with black pants and was believed to be traveling in a white 1990s Ford Explorer. Tribal officers in Browning were locked down due to their proximity to the bank. Officials say anyone seeing the suspect is asked to call local law enforcement, but not approach him because he should be considered armed and dangerous.
A Big Fork man has been ordered to pay over $618,000 in restitution to a woman whose leg was amputated after his pickup struck a motorcycle in July 2012. The Daily Interlake reports 48-year-old Brent Passwater also was sentenced Wednesday to 4 years with the Department of Corrections, followed by 6 years of probation. He pleaded guilty in October to negligent vehicular assault. Tests after the crash showed Passwater's blood alcohol level was twice the legal limit. Prosecutors say Passwater struck a motorcycle carrying Bryce and Lynn Boots while making a left turn off of Montana Highway 83 northeast of Big Fork. Lynn Boots' left leg had to be amputated below the knee. The state sought $1 million in restitution, while Passwater's attorney argued it should be closer to $117,000.
A 32-year-old Whitefish man has denied charges that he stole items from the home of a Flathead County Sheriff's deputy while the deputy was recovering from injuries suffered in a head-on crash. The Daily Interlake reports David Lamb pleaded not guilty to felony theft during a March 6th hearing in district court in Kalispell. Prosecutors allege Lamb stole a mountain bike, a firearm, and numerous tools while doing work on Deputy Robert Brower's house while Brower was hospitalized after the August 2013 crash. Most of the items were recovered at a pawn shop. Brower suffered two broken bones in his left leg and his left foot was crushed in the crash. He also suffered a broken right heel, kneecap, and wrist. The other driver is charged with felony negligent vehicular assault.
It's Women's History Month, and as we reported earlier, part of the observance at the University of Montana was a talk this week on the historical role of women in the U.S. Indian Service. University of New Mexico historian Kathleen Cahill is the author of the book Federal Fathers and Mothers, A Social History of the United States Indian Service, 1869 through 1933. In this feature interview, Cahill talks with news director Sally Mock about not only the significant role of women, but both Native and non-Native, but in the early years of what is now known as the Bureau of Indian Affairs, but also the growth in recent years of so-called social history.
Which is basically, you know, how did everyday people who weren't famous, weren't politicians, how did they live? What were their lives like? And you know, just learning about sort of things that seem really mundane, but actually are how most people would have experienced the past.
And did the blossoming of women's history facilitate social history in many ways? I mean, women historians were the ones who really first said, look, it isn't just the people who got elected to office who necessarily made history.
Exactly. Absolutely. And social history really comes out of that sort of political activism of the 1960s. So feminists and you know, people who are active in civil rights movements all began to say, you know, we have a history too, and it's important. So women's history really absolutely grows up with sort of what might be an umbrella group of social history, labor history, these sorts of questions.
And you have a book out on the social history of the U.S. Indian Service, mm-hmm. the period 1869 to 1933. And you looked at the fact that in that service, there were many women, both Native and non-Native, mm-hmm. who were employed by the Indian Service and had a great influence on how the policies of the U.S. government at that time were carried out.
Yes. And so the Indian Service, just to give you a brief definition, is the employees or the workforce of what becomes the Bureau of Indian Affairs. At the time, it was called the Office of Indian Affairs.
The precursor,
so,
really.
Yeah, it's basically just a name change, essentially. And it is, in the late 19th, early 20th century, becomes this very unique federal agency in that it employs large numbers of women, Native women and non-Native women, and married couples, which are it's just a very strange set of people working, which is what piqued my interest.
And I think you labeled it the first feminized federal agency.
Mm-hmm. It is, and it's the first. I mean, the federal government had sort of started to hire some women during the Civil War. There are women as seamstresses making uniforms, and there are some clerks being hired in Washington, D.C. But the Indian Service is a place where women were also influencing the policies and were really ideologically an important part of the mission of what the federal government was trying to do. And as a result, they're influential in policymaking, but they're also a large percentage in the school service, which is sort of half of the whole thing. They're 60%, which is, for, again, the 1890s, an enormous number of women working.
Mm-hmm. And the mission at that time was assimilation.
Absolutely. Right. So the idea that Native cultures were destined to die out, sort of anthropological theory, was that Native people were vanishing. But one way to stop that was to assimilate them into kind of Anglo-middle class culture. It also had the added bonus for the federal government of getting rid of the Native nations as political entities and entities with whom they had treaty obligations.
Mm-hmm. And they were trying to, you write, assimilate Natives to, quote, civilized gender roles, mm-hmm. to go from what were really in many tribal cultures, matrilineal cultures, to a patriarchal
yes,
role.
Absolutely. And that's why women are hired, because it's in Anglo culture, mothers do that important work of teaching children the right ways to behave, including gender roles. And so there's absolutely this push to change Native tribes from this multiplicity, as you say, of family types and, you know, inheritance patterns and just ways that people related to each other, right? Kinship networks that are not sort of nuclear family based. And an effort to get rid of all of that and remake them into these late 19th century, right, separate spheres that women do certain things and men do other things, and they're complementary.
And there was some contradiction, wasn't there, in that here were these women who were employed working in independent kinds of jobs, mm-hmm. promoting a dependence kind of role.
Absolutely. And that's, as I was doing the research, sort of part of what came out was that in hiring all of these people, there were a number of unintended consequences. And one of them is absolutely that women, and it's particularly the case for white women, but get this independence and are empowered in particular ways, even as they're teaching Native children to be sort of domestic helpmates. So it's absolutely one of the tensions that you see arise in the service.
It didn't work.
No. And it doesn't work for a lot of reasons. I think the main reason is the reason I call the book Federal Fathers and Mothers is that it's this effort to, particularly in the schools, with the boarding schools, remove Native children from their parents and replace those parents with basically surrogate parents who will teach them how to behave in a civilized, right, quote unquote, manner. And the children themselves resist this pretty adamantly that these employees are not going to take the place of their parents. But I also talk in the book quite extensively about how the Native employees in the service also, in many ways, do their best to work within the system to undermine or soften those goals, with some success in cases, in other cases not so much.
What did you, in doing this research, what most shocked you about this history or most surprised you?
That's a tough question. Mm-hmm. I mean, initially it was just the numbers of women in this employment. And then beyond that, the number of married women, married middle-class women, because married middle-class women are not working in this time period, not working for wages. They're working, you know, they're volunteers for charitable organizations and this sort of thing. But in the Indian Service, you have all of these husbands and wives working with their children there, which again creates these sort of unexpected moments. But it just – that's really unusual. And so as a historian of the 19th century, that struck me.
I'm sure it's a fascinating history and one that, again, only a social historian could could do. And I have been speaking with social historian Kathleen Cahill. She's an associate professor of history at the University of New Mexico. Dr. Cahill, thank you so much for giving us a glimpse of the early years of the U.S. Indian Service and the role of women in it.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
Now for this weekend's forecast. West of the Divide tonight, look for mostly cloudy skies with isolated snow showers and lows 11 to 18 degrees. Tomorrow should be mostly cloudy with a slight chance of snow and highs in the 30s to lower 40s. On Sunday, it calls for mostly cloudy skies with a chance of rain and snow. Highs should be in the upper 30s to mid 40s. In central Montana tonight, it should be mostly cloudy with a chance of snow through the night and lows should be in the single digits. Tomorrow, look for mostly cloudy skies with a chance of snow and highs should be in the 20s. Sunday calls for mostly cloudy skies with a chance of snow and highs in the 30s. And in southwest Montana tonight, it should be mostly cloudy with a slight chance of snow through the night and lows 10 to 15 degrees. Tomorrow, look for increasing clouds with a slight chance of snow through the day and highs 25 to 30 degrees. And on Sunday, it calls for mostly cloudy skies with a chance of snow and highs in the 30s.
Currently in our listening area, Helena is 29 degrees with sunny skies. In Kalispell, it's fair and 35 degrees. Butte has 30 degrees under partially cloudy skies. In Great Falls, it is snowing lightly with 17 degrees. Here in Missoula, the temperature under mostly cloudy skies is 38 degrees. It's 36 degrees and partly cloudy in Dillon. In Hamilton, it's fair and 39 degrees. Libby has 39 degrees with partly cloudy conditions. And in Polson, skies are partly cloudy and it's 32 degrees.
If you have a comment about tonight's newscast, you can send it via our webpage at mtpr.org or on Montana Public Radio's Facebook page. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Connor Ballantyne.
And I'm Madeline Beck. Thanks for listening and have a great weekend.